Studio. Till next time, I'm Dime Roberts. We're going to go out with more music from the Orchid Ensemble CD, Life, Death, Tears, Dream. More at orchidensemble.com. Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Village Building Convergence, taking place June 1st through 10th at locations all over Portland. The Village Building Convergence features over 30 community-built projects happening all over Portland, including the Mudbone Community Farm, Sherritt Square, and Portland University. Additionally, there are also ticketed evening events featuring speakers and local musicians. Again, that's the Village Building Convergence, taking place June 1st through 10th at locations all over Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
My name is Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Bob Cox. He's the director and owner of Augen Gallery, and he's here to talk about A.J. Garg Paintings, a show of paintings which is on now at Augen Gallery from June 6th to the 30th. Thanks for coming into KBOO, Bob.
Thanks for having me.
So A.J. Garg, he's an Indian painter, and he's 51. That's about all I know. Tell us what he does. These are very finely detailed paintings of traditional Indian narratives.
A.J. Garg makes paintings that represent the stories that come from the major royal texts that were created during the time of the empire, the Mughal emperors of Akbar, Baber, Shah Jahan, and Jahangir. There's a tremendously long traditional history of illuminated manuscripts, both among the Safavid Empire in Iran as well as the Mughal Empire in India. The Indian emperors, particularly Baber, was one of the first ones to import artists from the Safavid Empire in Iran to come to India and begin to school a set of royal painters that would create these texts and illuminated manuscripts that would glorify the emperor and the life during the emperor's times. A.J. Garg is a contemporary, but he's every bit as accomplished, both visually and artistically, as the skilled royal painters were 200 and 300 years ago. He's an unusual and rare artist in the sense that at the age of 1.5, he got an infection. The infection was misdiagnosed and mistreated, which left him deaf prior to his forming speech. And so he has grown up without hearing and without speech capabilities. He was originally being schooled to become a tailor when at about the age of 13 or 14, a royal court painter who was old at the time saw some of his paintings and agreed to take him on as a student. His family was able to do this at this point in time because they had slowly become prosperous enough where they didn't need the income from an additional sibling. And so he was able to train with these royal court painters. His older and younger brothers then dispersed throughout the world and began to work for different firms in England and the United States. And that's how we met the works of this artist. I had always been fascinated by Indian painting and Safavid painting ever since I saw illuminated manuscripts in the Frick Collection in New York and the Metropolitan Museum and the Morgan Library. And one day his brother walked in and said he had paintings from a fellow in India that he thought I should take a look at, and I took one look at them and said, these are fabulous paintings. They're as good as anything that sits in these major museums at this point in time. This guy was really accomplished. Mm-hmm. At the time, his brother was working for the Intel Corporation. Now he's up in Seattle working for another high-tech corporation. But that's how we basically ended up meeting the artist. The artist lives and works in Jaipur, which is a mid-sized town in India, meaning that it's not 10 million people. It's about 1.5 million people now. He works at home in an extended family. He lives in his brother's house and works there. He has a family of his own. He makes all of his own materials.
Mm-hmm. And these are gouaches, right?
These are gouaches with ground gold powder. He grinds up gold powder and mixes those in with pigments to create some of the colors. He creates a lot of his own gouache colors. He's come to visit us one time when we were able to get him through and get him a visa, which is difficult to get from that part of India due to its large Muslim population. But he brought his entire paint kit with him, which consisted of a number of clamshells, which he used to mix and grind his paint, and a myriad of brushes that he made himself. Many are made from a single squirrel hair. A squirrel hair is a very stiff hair that tends not to bend very easily and has an extremely sharp point on it, which allows him to paint these paintings with phenomenal detail. Mm-hmm. He uses a magnifying glass because the detail is so fine that in order to paint them specifically the way he wants, he has to look at them under a 10 to 20 magnification.
Mm-hmm. So one of the pieces is called City Visit, and it's basically people visiting. They look like merchants getting off horses, and it looks like all the local guys have come out to see who they are and to meet them. Some of them are armed, some of them are on camels. Do you know what's going on in this picture?
These were stories about traders that kept the Mughal Empire in merchandise. If you understand the Mughal Empire, when Genghis Khan conquered the world, he was very responsible for setting up a number of different kinds of things that were very essential to the empire. They created the first Pony Express, for instance, which allowed transportation over this extended empire, which reached from Kiev to Beijing. He set up the first mail system where they could move information across the empire. And because the empire was joined from east to west by a common information system, there was a lot of cross-pollination of trade that occurred. And this was something that the empire and the emperors valued greatly at that point in time. And so there were lots of paintings of this particular aspect of their culture that occurred in their illuminated manuscripts.
Mm-hmm. So they would have been books of stories with illuminations, and then this painter, Garg, is doing... He's riffing off the stories, but not off the actual original imagery.
He's representing the stories and the culture of the Mughal Empire as it existed for the 200 years between Akbar and Jahangir.
Mm-hmm. What decade was that?
These were from the late 1490s through the early 1700s, were those empire periods of time.
Mm-hmm. Is there much in the figuration or in the perspective that sort of parallels European art of that time?
European art, and particularly the Illuminated manuscripts that were created in the 12th, 13th, and 14th century in Europe, take a great deal of influence from some of the manuscripts that were created by the Safavids in Iran. Marco Polo's time period is about 1200 to 1250. And so as Marco Polo began to move across the Eastern empires, he began to bring things back, or there was a lot of things that came back into Europe that then got co-opted by the Christian faith, and that's when you begin to see lots of illuminated manuscripts of what was important to them at the time, which was the illustrations in the Bible, mm-hmm. and the Bible stories begin to occur. Mm-hmm. So there's a familiar relationship between the illuminated manuscripts in Europe and Asia at that time. They told stories, they presented the culture in the way that the rulers wanted to have the culture presented. The works in Europe tended to differ a little bit from the works in Asia in that as the Renaissance began to come in, you saw much more traditional perspective come into the illuminated manuscripts because that's what the Renaissance painters were mostly interested in, presenting and coming up with theories about how to present realistic perspective. Less so, it was less important in the Far East and in Asia at the time to present things in a realistic perspective type of way.
You have a piece called In the Palace, and it shows a woman dancing, and she's got like a see-through skirt and trousers. Kind of looks like a belly dancer. She looks like she's dancing for a royal couple. He's smoking a hookah, and there's sort of handmaidens around them. And then there's a band, a five-piece, all-women band, sort of down the bottom of the steps with the dancer. And then all these railings that are part of the palace and the sort of octagonal roof of the building, they look like they're trying for Western perspective, but they're not. They don't really line up. It looks like you use a ruler a lot. You know, there's some very straight edges and then things that are, you know, don't match the perspective. Is he doing this informed by the West, or is he copying exactly what they did then?
No, he's not copying what they did then, but he's not formally trained as an architect, and so therefore a lot of these drawings have multiple different vanishing points, which you wouldn't have if you were looking at a perspective in a very technical way. But he's presenting them in a pictorial way so that he can get all the objects into the field of vision and is less concerned with one palace or one set of walls vanishing to a different place than a set of parallel walls would be vanishing to. And it does create a certain amount of visual interest as well as, when you look at it from a technical standpoint, a certain amount of visual discord.
And the detail in this is incredible with the flowers, the pattern on the carpet. All the clothing has its own, you know, these are printed fabrics that he goes into great detail. What do you know how long it takes to do one of these?
Each painting takes multiple weeks to execute. And 2, 3, 4 weeks, depending on how large it is.
Yeah, and he's doing like one at a time?
He's doing them one at a time. He has a different sensibility of concentration because he is deaf. He doesn't have great deals of auditory distractions during the day while he's working, so it allows him the ability to concentrate, and you know, he actually gets quite a bit of work done in a particular session, even though they're detailed with thousands and thousands and thousands of little marks on the paper.
Mm-hmm. Now, was the original works from that era, they were contained within books and manuscripts?
Most of the works were contained in books and manuscripts, and they were basically the royal diaries mm-hmm. of the time.
Yeah, and they were single copies. So
and they were single copies,
they
unique.
Printed.
They were not printed.
So they were not seen very much. I mean, no. The book could be closed for years at a time.
And a lot of them glorified the reign of Babur or of Shah Jahan. I mean, that was the intention. The emperor commissioned these artists to make himself look great.
Mm-hmm. So this guy's got a totally different place in the world. He's making them for public view. He's distributed by his brother at Intel, right. Or whatever, Seattle. He's got this kind of global outlet.
Right. He's exhibited in England. He's exhibited in the United States. He has a number of galleries working his work in India, in Bombay, in Jaipur, and places like that.
Mm-hmm.
He's won a tremendous amount of awards in India for the kind of work that he's done.
So you have 16 of these up on show in the gallery in June. And are they presented as a narrative, or are they themed? Or how has he given you these 16?
None of them have. The entire exhibition does have it. Does not have a single theme. It is multiple themes that run through Indian mythology, Indian history. Some of the paintings deal with the royal family. Some of the paintings deal with the Hindu script revolving around Krishna. And some of the paintings are simply modest domestic scenes.
Mm-hmm. Does he make up any subject matter of his own?
A lot of the domestic scenes are all invented by him, yes.
Mm-hmm. Domestic, but set in period.
Right.
Right.
Executed the way the other period pieces would have been executed.
Yeah. Do you know how he decides when he's going to stick to history?
I don't, because we don't have a great deal of communicating. I don't know Indian Sign Language, and he doesn't know English.
That's amazing. So that when these ones show up, you literally not sure what you're going to get? Or do you pick from?
We pick. We choose from a set of works that his brother has brought into the country.
Mm-hmm. My name's Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Bob Cox. He's the owner and director of Augen Gallery, and he's talking about A.J. Garg Paintings, which runs at Augen from June 6th to the 30th. You have another one, which is Krishna Up a Tree.
I'm not perfectly skilled in the mythology of the Hindu texts, but this painting presents Krishna up a tree, and Krishna has stolen the clothing of the gopis who are his attendants, and while they were bathing in one of the rivers.
Mm-hmm.
As I say, I'm not that skilled in the mythology revolving around Krishna, but Krishna and the gopis is this theme that runs through Hindu texts and Hindu religious texts. Krishna is always depicted in blue, mm-hmm. and there are a number of paintings in the show of the Krishna deity depicted in blue.
Mm-hmm. So he's up a tree. He's hung the clothes on different branches right. above him so they can't reach, and they're sort of coyly pleading from the water, which is at waist height,
right.
To get their clothes back. And there's some peacocks and lilies, and a landscape in the background, sort of a rounded hills with houses and trees and a sunset sky. Do you think he gives himself a lot more free rein when he has a subject like this?
Oh, absolutely. He's done extensive paintings of Krishna and his cows, and he's made paintings of Krishna as a baby, which you very seldom see. Krishna being scolded by his mother, which you very seldom see in anything coming out of India at this point in time. So with his Hindu and domestic scenes, he's much more free to interpret and invent than he is with the texts that deal with and the paintings that deal with the Mughal texts.
The Mughals, right. Yeah. And the Mughal stuff is it more about power and trade and politics less about religion?
Yeah, it's more about what happened in the royal kind of setting in the empire, because that tended to be what the emperors wanted the painters to paint about at that point in time, to glorify the reign, to glorify the wealth of the emperor, to glorify the power of the emperor.
You have another piece called King and Queen in the Lake. So it's a sort of royal couple on a boat surrounded by musicians and another dancer. It's like they brought their own little court with them out on the boat. And they're in a kind of a lake. Very interesting looking lake, because it almost looks like it's turning to land, the blue, because of the curves. It looks like the water's not flat anymore at the back. And then there are palaces on the edge that... The foreground one is much smaller than the one in the background.
Right.
Which is, you know, either suggesting the one in the background is gigantic, or he's just playing with perspective again.
Right.
Which do you think it is?
I think the palace in the background is the main palace. The palace in the foreground is an antecedent palace. But he is also playing with perspective. The foreground appears to be much smaller than the background pieces, and even the doorways in the one closest up are the same size as the doorways in the one that would be dramatically distant, which you would never see. Mm-hmm. You would never see that. And then there are a number of huts that are not part of the palace that actually appear to be larger than some of the aspects of the palace.
They look like the kingdom.
I mean, he's just playing with, you know, visual tricks.
Mm-hmm. And then he has this border of flowers.
There's a very decorative border around the edges in many cases. Some are repeating patterns of flowers. Some are just simply repeating patterns. Either, you know, flowing patterns or geometric patterns, but he tends to create a picture within a border. He's making his own frame for it, not knowing how it's going to be presented when it actually goes out to the public. He's presenting it in the frame that he wants people to see it in.
Mm-hmm. But you
and the frames are all hand painted.
Right, right. But you frame them. Where do you think they'll end up, these paintings?
We've sold hundreds to different private collectors and different institutions now.
Mm-hmm. Like,
we've been exhibiting his work for about 15 to 20 years. So
in Portland, you might go into someone's drawing room and find one of these on the wall.
Very possible,
with
yeah.
all their other contemporary art.
Right.
And do you think the owners are going to... Is their story, hey, this guy is contemporary. This is not, you know, 500-year-old painting.
Yeah, I think the people that are collecting them not only have at least some rudimentary interest in the culture of India, but also appreciate the tremendous detail and quality and workmanship and the stories that they're seeing in these paintings. The paintings are absolutely remarkable when you look at the detail and how they're painted and how they're made. And then there's also the unusual story that goes behind how this man came from a handicapped third world country to create something that is cherished in a prosperous first world country.
Mm-hmm. Do you think some of them might end up in the Frick one day?
Hard to say. I can't tell.
Do your collectors, what do they do with their collections?
Some of them donate it to institutions. Some of the collectors pass away and their children inherit them. Some of the collectors pass away and their children may sell them back into the marketplace or find another place to donate them. it's always hard to track the history of where the children go out to.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like the marketplace has become more efficient in the digital age?
Certainly the access to the marketplace has become much broader and much more democratic. Don't know whether it's efficient because it's very difficult to tell once it goes up on the internet actually where it goes, and if it goes someplace, it might go up on the internet and be available for a period of time, and then you can't tell whether it sells. It just may disappear from the internet. Mm-hmm. And may go back into a collection or back into somebody's stock. And so in that way, there is less transparency because you don't know what the outcome is.
Mm-hmm. But it's certainly a bigger market. I mean, people can
It's a bigger market. Certainly, you know, 25 years ago, we probably never would have been able to make sales to South Africa, for instance, which we're able to make now.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm not traveling there and that customer is not traveling to the far reaches of Western America. So it does democratize the information for sure.
Mm-hmm. And briefly, you have another show called Face, which is portraits. These are prints. Now, you're a great print dealer. So, and the list of artists on your website who you deal with prints of is pretty amazing. You know, all the big names, Hockney, Warhol, just everyone. What's the market for prints like these days?
The market for prints is at the best level that it's ever been at. Due to the democratic aspect of the internet, these major Western artists and European artists are now being collected in South America, in Asia, in the Indian subcontinent, and so a lot of these artists who have become well known over the years have an international marketplace, and many of them who are still alive have become incredibly wealthy due to the international marketplace.
For their prints, though.
For the prints more and their paintings.
Yeah. But I mean, if somebody has a healthy line of prints, they're alive, they can realistically keep reproducing to satisfy the market.
They can produce new images, but they can't recreate the old images necessarily. A lot of the matrices that these guys use to make the prints have been destroyed a long, long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why print collecting has become a significant part of the international marketplace. Obviously, as the painting prices accelerate, and they've been accelerating dramatically again. At the last auction, for instance, in New York, when they sold the David Rockefeller collection, there wasn't a single painting that sold for under $1 million. That leaves lots of people out of the ability to collect things.
Mm-hmm.
And so prints have begun to backfill into those areas, and now certain prints have begun to sell for dramatically higher prices. When the Basquiat painting sells for $115 million, that takes the Basquiat prints up another $10,000 or $15,000 or $20,000 per print.
Mm-hmm.
So the prints that were released at $8,000 and $9,000 15 years ago are now selling for $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, $80,000.
Mm-hmm.
And a certain group of people then get left out of that. And so younger artists fill back into the lower areas of the marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the artists that we started handling in the 70s were pretty modestly priced back then. Not so modestly priced anymore.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week was Bob Cox. He's the owner and director of Augen Gallery, and he was here talking about A.J. Garg Paintings, which is on now June the 6th through 30th. Thanks for coming into KBOO, Bob.
Thanks for having me.
Don't worry. I won't hurt you. I only want you
Oh yeah, come ride and dance with Diablo all over Portland as we celebrate Prince's birthday on Thursday, June 7th at 8 p.m. with a mobile bicycle dance party. We'll be rocking Pedalpalooza and dropping the Prince jams all night long with frequent dance stops. Once again, that's Prince's birthday bike ride celebration, Thursday, June 7th at 8 p.m. For more information on the KBOO website under Community Events.
Join KBOO and Kofallen Cultural Center on Thursday, June 14th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater for an evening of storytelling, live music, and film. Malian artist, author, and storyteller Baba Wage Jakite starts with a talk on the background of the Empire of Mali and the role of West Africa's oral historians before the screening of Keita, Heritage of the Griots, a film which blends modern events with magical realism, mythology, and history. Again, that's an evening of the culture of Mali, including the screening of the film Keita, Heritage of the Griots, on Thursday, June 14th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Esto está en la Gómez Daza para KBOO News. A continuación, un corte informativo en español para el día 5 de junio. Un sismo de magnitud 5.2 estremeció este lunes la costa de Guatemala, un día después